got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Most Americans have heard of methadone. It's an opioid used for opioid maintenance therapy in opioid dependence and for chronic pain management as well. Methadone was developed in Germany around 1938 by scientists who were looking for a synthetic opioid that could be created with readily available precursors to solve Germany's opium shortage problem and was widely used by the German army during World War II. After the war, all German patents, trade names, and research records were requisitioned and expropriated by the Allies.
In the early 1950s, methadone was also investigated in order to use it as a medication to stop coughing.
It was only in 1947 that the drug was given the generic name of methadone by the American Medical Association. Since the German patent rights were no longer protected, each drug company interested in the formula could buy the rights for the commercial production of methadone for just $1. But we really want to talk today about another drug whose name also starts with the same four letters, M-E-F. I'm now talking about methamphetamine.
Methamphetamine is a powerful central nervous system stimulant. You may not know it, but methamphetamine does have some legitimate medical uses, such as the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
But unfortunately, as most of you already know, it is a widely trafficked and purchased for recreational consumption, often as crystal meth. It can be smoked, snorted, ingested, or injected.
Users often report euphoria, increased alertness, and reduced appetite, and chronic users may experience paranoia, delusions, and unpredictable mood swings.
Many addicts exhibit a binge and crash pattern, and many try to maintain the rush with continuous consumption. Chances of addiction are high, and symptoms from withdrawal can linger for months. The treatment is complicated, particularly because many meth users are often also using cocaine, heroin, or alcohol along with the methamphetamine.
A major problem is that meth is directly toxic to the brain and causes developmental delays in meth babies. In adults, it is also associated with an increased risk for Parkinson's disease. Take a look at most addicts. Have you noticed that they often appear to age at an accelerated pace?
They commonly acquire what is often called meth mouth, that is, tooth loss, tooth decay, and tooth blackening. And there are those who develop psychoses and abnormal heart rhythms. Now, unlike opioid overdoses, which can quickly be resolved if the drug naloxone is available, meth overdoses have no reversal agent.
At a hospital, meth is suctioned from the stomach. Antipsychotics can help with psychosis, and antihypertensive drugs can reduce acutely elevated blood pressure.
Just like methadone, methamphetamine has a dark history where meth played a sinister role in the World War II Nazi war machine. The military, along with German civilians, used a commercial form of the drug to stay awake, alert, and energized. With this drug called Pervitin, which was the brand name of methamphetamine in Germany, factory workers and homemakers alike found that they could work longer and harder. As a matter of fact, the troops even called it tank chocolate or pilot's salt. It literally fueled the Nazis during their blitzkrieg invasion of France in 1940.
The toll that meth took on the German was immense. It provoked war crimes, stopped psychosis and triggered suicide. As the war progressed, Adolf Hitler himself received ever-increasing doses of the drug.
Now, 75 years after the war, and we still have no effective drug therapy. Before we get to the medical news of the day, which could end up much more than that, being the news of the decade or even the century, who knows? We'd like to tell you about MRSA, often called MRSA. The letters stand for Methicillin Resistant Staph aureus, MRSA.
Staph aureus causes a bacterial infection, and methicillin is what is called a semisynthetic penicillin antibiotic. It acts by inhibiting the synthesis of bacterial cell walls, thereby killing the bacteria.
I want to reiterate that. It kills bacteria, not viruses. The coronavirus is a virus, not a bacteria. Anyway, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus infection is caused by a type of staph bacteria that's become resistant to many of the antibiotics used to treat ordinary staph infections, including methicillin.
Most MRSA infections occur in people who have been in hospitals or other healthcare settings, such as nursing homes and dialysis centers. So when it occurs in these settings, is known as healthcare-associated MRSA.
These HA MRSA infections typically are associated with invasive procedures or devices, such as surgeries, intravenous tubing, or even artificial joints. Now, there is another type of MRSA, and that has occurred in the wider community among healthy people. This form is often called community-associated MRSA and often begins as a painful skin boil.
It's spread by skin-to-skin contact, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Around 2% of the population chronically carries the type of staph bacteria known as MRSA.
You could say that bacteria live on an evolutionary fast track, so germs that survive treatment with one antibiotic soon become resistant to others as they are used to treat the diseases. Now, getting back to our present medical predicament here in the U.S., regardless of where and how it started, coronavirus has come to the United States.
It is not the first and most likely not the last coronavirus to affect humans with human-to-human transmission of the virus, and although it is now called the novel coronavirus or COVID, COVID-19. It is just one of many coronaviruses.
Others include SARS and MERS, among many others. The first may have been human coronavirus 229E, or HCoV-229E, which is a species of coronavirus which infects humans and bats.
Next was human coronavirus, OC43, or HCoV-229E. OC43, which infect humans and cattle. We then go to the year 2003, which saw severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus, or SARS-CoV, which is the strain of virus that causes severe acute respiratory syndrome, which is where the acronym SARS comes from. The virus infects humans, bat, and palm civets.
Human coronavirus NL63, or HCoV-NL63, is a species of coronavirus that is found primarily in young children, the elderly, and immunocompromised patients with acute respiratory illness. It also has a seasonal association in temperate climates, like ours. Then there was the human coronavirus, aptly called HKU1, or HCoV-HKU1, which is a species that originated from infected mice.
In 2005, and later Middle East Respiratory Syndrome-related coronavirus, which is where we get the acronym MERS-CoV, which is a species of coronavirus which infects humans, bat, and camels.
Then in 2019, we get back to a SARS variant called SARS-CoV-2. Most of these have involved serious respiratory tract infections.
So, As you can see, coronaviruses are a group of viruses that causes diseases in mammals and other animals. In humans, coronaviruses causes respiratory tract infections that are typically mild, such as the common cold. Though rarer forms, as we said, such as SARS, MERS, and COVID-19, can be lethal.
By the way, the name coronavirus is derived from the Latin word corona, meaning crown or halo, which refers to the characteristic microscopic appearance that kind of looks like a king's crown.
More than 100,000 cases of the new coronavirus have been confirmed worldwide across more than 60 countries, and more than 3,400 people have died, according to data from Johns Hopkins University.
As the rate of new cases in China begins to decline, hot zones are cropping up all over Europe and the Middle East. In the United States, the death toll is creeping upward as new cases are confirmed across the nation. It is true that the new coronavirus is genetically different, which means no one is immune to it and therefore haven't developed antibodies against it. Everybody is potentially at risk for developing infection, some of which, as we said, can be severe. However, from data we have so far, overall there's about a 2 to 2.5% mortality rate.
What is difficult with this strain is it appears people can have it, not be sick, and still potentially transmit it.
Speaking of symptoms, the present coronavirus is more similar than it's different from the flu from the standpoint of how it is transmitted. So what should someone do if they have those flu-like symptoms? Well, first, we recommend that you do contact your physician at that point. Masks are not especially effective for preventing someone from getting the coronavirus. Healthcare workers or patients who have the coronavirus should use the mask to reduce the spread when coughing or sneezing. And remember that masks also need to be fit appropriately.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
The Surgeon General of the United States says that masks won't protect from the coronavirus. The first defense against coronavirus is 20 seconds of proper hand washing.
You know, it's still not too late to get the flu shot. We're in the middle of a very active influenza season, and it is usually active through April. Again, remember that the second line of defense is wash your hands, just like the first line. A lot of respiratory infections are spread on the hands. You can also use alcohol-based sanitizers. After a sneeze, some coronaviruses have stayed on hard surfaces, like desktops and doorknobs, and can stay active for hours.
We don't know if this happens with the novel coronavirus. A precaution is to use alcohol, bleach, detergent, or antiviral topical to wipe doorknobs and tabletops.
You can even use hydrogen peroxide and wipe down the desks, computer keyboards, anything that people touch. Remember that with influenza and other seasonal viruses, most of the morbidity is due to pneumonias.
This is exactly what happened with Ebola. Even before there was an effective vaccine, the more intensive care that is provided for supportive care could be associated with better outcomes.
Now, you may be confused with some of the terms being bandied about concerning the coronavirus, such as what does endemic, global outbreak, epidemic, and pandemic all mean? Endemic simply indicates that the infection stays within a community, like the seasonal influenza we get every year.
What we have now is a global outbreak, meaning that it has spread globally. On the other hand, An epidemic means that there is a high level of activity in one particular area of the world.
Finally, we come to the term pandemic, which is when you start to have large activities in other continents and sustained transmission, in other words, spread from person to person. We now do have coronavirus cases on every continent except Antarctica.
The coronavirus will probably be declared a pandemic. The last pandemic was the H1N1 in 2009.
So how costly will testing be for individuals? According to the Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans, the CDC isn't charging patients. Now that could change. The U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have already created a billing code for coronavirus testing, and other labs could get emergency authorization from the FDA for testing. Jennifer Cates, the director of global health and HIV policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation, said that there could be other costs involved. For example, visits to the doctor's office and the emergency room can cost patients money. It could all come down to coverage.
According to Vice President Pence, neither cost nor diagnostic criteria should deter any American from being tested. He also said that a doctor's order will be all that is needed for any Americans to be tested for the coronavirus.
Pence was also adamant in stating to the public that effective immediately, any clinician or healthcare authority will be able to administer the test. He also assured the public that the test will be covered by private health insurance as well as Medicare and Medicaid. Now that's a little bit disconcerting to me, as the phrase covered by private health care insurance can be really a very vacuous statement. If the written cost for the test is, say, $1,000, and a person wants to have the test performed, will that mean that even if the person has a copay or deductible, then they will not have to pay for the test? I don't know. They haven't explained that to us yet.
And getting even closer to home, Florida State's official says they don't have enough testing kits to meet federal guidelines for who should be tested.
Governor Ron DeSantis spokeswoman Helen Aguirre Ferre stated that the state simply didn't have the resources to meet its latest guidance, which was to test anyone who physicians suspect might have the coronavirus. At this point, the state of Florida cannot even meet the more limited criteria for testing that has been used since the weekend, meaning testing only those people who traveled to certain places with the disease, or had close contact with someone infected, or have a severe lower respiratory illness of unknown origin requiring hospitalization.
In a Thursday morning update, the Florida Department of Health said it had tested only about 100 people and is still waiting for the results in 69 of those tests.
Along with 31 negatives, there have been 3 positives confirmed earlier this week and 1 announced Thursday following 5 days of testing. Now let's go over what we can do to prevent infections with the virus. Scientists say that the coronavirus can survive on metal, plastic, and glass for as long as 9 days. You heard me right, 9 days.
We have already said that the virus can spread through hands and surfaces, including door handles, telephone receivers, elevator buttons, call buttons, bedside tables, and anything patients in hospital frequently touch.
The best way to combat coronavirus is staying on common surfaces, such as glass, metal, and plastic, is by cleaning them with a solution that's rubbing alcohol and 0.5% hydrogen peroxide, or even 0.1% sodium hypochlorite within 1 minute of contamination.
But there is another easy step you should consider to stay protected, and that is to clean your smartphone. I'm not talking about cleaning or clearing your phone memory. I'm talking about sanitizing the phone and the case.
When was the last time that you actually cleaned the surface of your phone? A study from the University of Arizona found your phone is covered with 10 times the amount of bacteria found on a toilet seat. But you have to be careful, since most disinfectants will do more harm than good to your phone. There are good UV sanitizers for your phones and tablets, but you could be spending $50 or more just for one of them.
Prepare to get by for at least a week on what you have at home. You may be unable to get to a store, or stores may not be open or may have limited supplies for weeks.
Public service may also be disrupted, so prepare for outages in electricity, water, and garbage services. Keep extra supplies on hand, like flashlights and batteries.
Stock up on good supply of canned meats, such as tuna, chicken, turkey, canned beans, fruits, vegetables, soups, and even protein or fruit bars, dry cereal or granola, dry fruit, and crackers.
How about that good old American staple? Peanut butter and jelly. Also on the list are nuts and trail mix, and even your comfort foods such as cookies, candies, instant coffee, and even tea bags. Canned juices and bottled water. It's always a good time to have several of these on hand, just in case. If you have infants, don't forget to have plenty of baby formula on hand. How about pet food? Cat litter, if you're unable to get to a store for a while.
Do you know that services like Amazon and even Costco and Walmart can deliver within 2 hours? We are not trying to scare anyone. It is always good to have this on hand for any emergencies. Don't forget that disposable diapers and feminine supplies, even working flashlights and a portable radio.
I still have one of those that I bought before the last hurricane scare. Now, don't rely on electric can openers. Keep a manual one in your drawer. You can run out of toilet paper and tissues as well. You might get bored, so keep some entertainment on hand. And don't forget extra cash. Getting back to the smartphone, say you can't or do not want to spend that extra money on the UV sanitizer.
First, turn off your phone, then take a microfiber cloth and combine warm water with some soap and wipe the screen and back surface down. Avoid using sanitizing wipes or liquid sanitizers because they can harm your phone.
For plastic phone cases, use a chlorine bleach and water solution. Be sure to scrub the crevices with a toothbrush or sponge. For rubber or silicone cases, use dish soap and water to scrub the case. You can also add baking soda to remove any stains, but don't skip the dish soap for disinfecting purposes. And another tip to keep your phone clean, don't take it to the bathroom. Now, to get off the subject of the coronavirus, did you know that a group of MIT scientists are using machine learning algorithms? The researchers have identified a powerful new antibiotic compound that killed many of the world's most problematic disease-causing bacteria, including some strains that are resistant to all known antibiotics.
The computer model, which can screen more than 100 million chemical compounds in a matter of days, is designed to pick out potential antibiotics that kill bacteria using different mechanisms than those of existing drugs.
Their approach revealed a molecule which is arguably one of the more powerful antibiotics that has been discovered. In their new study, the researchers also identified several other promising antibiotic candidates, which they plan to test further.
They also believe the model could be used to design new drugs based on what he has learned about chemical structures that enable drugs to kill bacteria. Current methods for screening new antibiotics are often prohibitively costly, require a significant time investment, and are usually limited to a narrow spectrum of chemical diversity.
Using a different machine learning model, the researchers also showed that this molecule would likely have low toxicity to human cells. They called the molecule Halicin, after the fictional artificial intelligence system from 2001, A Space Odyssey. Maybe if you're old enough to even remember the movie 2001, you also remember the name of the computer was HAL, H-A-L. Kind of a cute name, since it appears that this was concocted from the name of a very famous computer company. Just take each letter in the name HAL and raise it up one so that H becomes I, A becomes B, and finally L becomes M to create the word IBM.
The researchers then tested Halicin against dozens of bacterial strains isolated from patients and grown in lab dishes, and found that it was able to kill many that are resistant to treatment, including Clostridium difficile, Acinetobacter baumannii, and Mycobacterium tuberculosis. The strain of A. baumannii that they use is resistant to all known antibiotics, but application of a Halicin-containing ointment completely cleared the infections within 24 hours. hours, the researchers plan to pursue further studies of harnessing, working with a pharmaceutical company or nonprofit organization in hopes of developing it for use in humans.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.